Clubhouse.
Welcome to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home with your hosts, Beth Kushnick and Caroline Daly.
Welcome to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home. This is Caroline. Hey, Beth. Can you believe we are already in the second half of season 5?
Hi, Caroline. No, it's gone so fast with so many great interviews and conversations, but I'm really excited because this week it's very special for me. We're speaking to my mentor, Stephen Hendrickson, production designer extraordinaire. Stephen is a legend in the business and a person who I am lucky enough to call a dear friend.
I am so happy we got to do this interview. I know in the interview, Stephen talks about how he got his start in the business, but I need you to fill in a little missing piece for all of our listeners. How did you and Stephen actually meet?
I was lucky enough to be called by Stephen to do a series of Ethan Allen commercials. And in those days, they were extremely extensive, very large commercials where on that job we had, I think, 6 stages at Silver Cup Studios, many of which were devoted to the sets, and the other stages were devoted to just storing the Ethan Allen furniture, because other than flowers and plants and draperies and things, everything we used on set was from Ethan Allen. I will tell you that it was at the beginning of my career, and I was thoroughly intimidated. I don't know, it just worked out perfectly. We just really got along and seemed to have the same visual affinity for things and vocabulary, and those were many years ago, but that's really what led to all our subsequent work. And when I look back at my IMDb page, my resume, my list of movies, a significant portion of them, of my jobs, were with Stephen.
Listening to your interview, it is so clear that you and Stephen have a shorthand with each other. I feel like your collaboration just must be seamless, but I'm so curious if that came just right at the very beginning, or is that something that you guys worked on together to actually get on the same page?
I don't think it was immediate, just because of my nerves. You know, Stephen had a reputation and it was something new for me. And I think once we got through the first couple of jobs, it just became more seamless. True collaboration is exactly what the film and television industry is based on. The connection between production designer and set decorator is special, and it's vital not only for telling the story visually, but between the set decoration and the art department, we're running usually one of the biggest, if not the largest, departments on any given show. So there has to be real collaboration. I think doing episodic television really honed our unspoken connection. When he goes and is working with the prepping director and I'm left with the shooting director, you know, our jobs sort of get blurred, and our collaboration, even the unspoken part, you know, is just vitally important. So I'm covering for him and he's calling information into me or sending me photographs. I mean, of course, we started in the days before that was even possible. So we just seem to have this seamless connection. And he is one of the most visually literate people that I've ever met. His ability to understand filmmaking, everything, all the references that are so important. He's got all of them. Architecture, art, design, decorating, all that background. And we just sort of revel in all of it, sharing all of it. Stephen and I always had a love for design books and for any kind of reference books. When we were on location in Baltimore on a movie, we used to go shopping at this store that had, you know, overruns of different design books. And every time we had a minute of a break, we'd be there buying these like incredible design books for $10, $12, and $15. And we both accrued quite a collection through the years, but those books were kind of our reference points, our research, no matter what they were about, tablescapes or drapery or window treatments, anything. They were odd, but, you know, we added them to the collection. And throughout the years, he's been trying to get rid of some of his books, and I've been trying to get rid of mine. And he sends me a book that he's trying to get rid of, and I send one back. So it's not really working. We still have our book collection going, but it gave us something to pore over and reference. And you know, whether it was another television show or a movie, something, we seem to always have the same kind of opinion or feeling about things. And I think that is what really contributed to our successful collaboration.
Beth, you gave me a new goal. I need better visual literacy. Clearly, that phrase is going to stick with me. Yeah, well, it is going to say, no, now you trademarked it. Now it's yours, Beth. It is
yours. I did. Hashtag visual literacy.
Yes, because this is something that we talk about a lot, about how it's very difficult for people to take an idea, something they see, and then actually bring it to life. This is huge. I know that you and Stephen worked together for over 25 years and on more than 200 episodes of television and many films. So tell us a little bit about what that's meant to you.
You know, I think it developed to a point where we also had the same attitude. You know, on any job, we were always the people who said yes. You know, if they come to you and it's a Thursday afternoon and it's going to rain and they have to shuffle the schedule, or an actor gets sick, or they decide they don't want to go out, they want to stay on the stage. You know, what can you do for us? Even though we'd close the door after they'd leave and say, holy hell, how are we going to do this? We always put on the same professional, positive face. And that was something that we dealt with through years of difficulty. You know, we had some challenges in the days of our episodic television show with certain personalities and people who made drastic demands. Even though we'd come home and download and talk to each other, and as Stephen would say, I've got my glass of wine, I'm ready to lay it out.
Let's solve.
Yeah. We still maintained this positive attitude, and I think Stephen always expressed his faith in me. In the interview, you'll hear about, you know, I'd always make this phone call, especially when things were drafted on a computer and they might have been wrong, or we were reusing and repurposing a certain wall from one set to another. And, you know, I'd always get to that point where, okay, I have room for the bed, but I only have room for one end table and not another. And I always would look at the furniture plan and think, oh, this is never going to work, and feel uninspired. And, you know, by the end of our time working on one show, he didn't even get all the words out when I would call him, and he would say to me, take a breath and you know what to do, you know, and it would eventually work. It may have taken a little bit of movement of the furniture, and that's what the set dressers are for, and they were patient with me. But a lot of these locations and situations and, you know, 200 episodes of TV, that's a lot of continually problem solving.
I was shocked when I saw it on our paper, Beth. I was like, 200, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, I just can imagine those late nights, those wine or coffee fueled, like just problem solving sessions. I have to be just so wild. I can't even imagine.
I didn't even drink coffee in those days.
Oh, my. That's amazing. Yeah. I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you guys did it and not, like, just be like, enough already. I'm so tired of, like, having to try to figure this out. Obviously, this made for a very, very layered and beautiful relationship that you and Stephen have formed. What are some highlights over the years of you guys working together?
Well, I really do remember fondly the job we did on location in Baltimore. We were down there recreating Amish country for Richer or Poorer with Tim Allen and Kirsty Alley. And we actually grew corn. We had to grow fields of corn. And that was a production design, believe it or not, and set decorating job. That was very interesting. You know, I think he taught me so much about how you become an expert in the film business on whatever character development you're doing or whatever is required by the script. You know, we became more of an expert on law when we started The Good Wife and The Good Fight. The concepts behind evil brought us to another place. And that thirst for knowledge that he always had and the ability to do the research and tap into all this really great stuff that inspired us, I can't say enough. He has taught me more about the film and television business, and we were in each other's lives at the pivotal points when our kids were growing up, and he's everything to me.
I feel so incredibly lucky that we get to share this special conversation, one that seemed five podcast seasons in the making, to actually have Stephen come on.
It really is.
It's amazing. Listeners, please stay tuned now for Beth and producer Mike's interview with legendary production designer Stephen Hendrickson.
Joining us today is Stephen Hendrickson, a true legend of the business, an Emmy-nominated production designer working for over 40 years in the industry. Stephen has seemingly done it all, and we are so excited to have him here today. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm fine.
I'm thrilled that you're with us. It's just my most perfect collaborator who I've worked with for many years. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us. It's an honor for me. Tell us a little bit of the start of how you became a production designer.
Well, it probably goes back way more than 40 years. I look at myself as really starting as a designer in high school because, of course, there were school plays endlessly, and we had a fairly decent stage, and there was nobody else the least bit interested, so I did it and just learned to take the available flats and paint them again and stand them up and borrow furniture from my grandmother and put on shows. I became a real theater major when I went to college and did design as my major within the theater major, and worked for many years at Antioch College and in the various theaters that were there. After that, I went to Yale Drama School in the design department as a set designer and did my graduate degree there 3 years, and then worked in theater for quite a while after that around the country in regional theaters. Eventually, once I had moved to New York, I joined the union in New York, United Scenic Artists, and that then was my gateway into film, because I could get jobs on film sets initially as a painter, and not long after doing that, I was invited to the art department because I was one of the people that was around the production who could draft. They asked for, anybody here know how to draft? And I raised my hands.
And that's draft with a pencil, right?
Oh, yes, yes. This is back in 1972 or so. So I went upstairs to the art department, and I've stayed there and worked my way as a draftsman and then as an art director, and eventually was sort of by chance, I was kind of handed my own movie to do because the production designer who was on it left for various reasons. And there I was with a police drama kind of shot in Bedford-Stuyvesant. But that was my first credit, all my own, and my first movie that I put together. And that's how I got started, you know, just sort of one step after another. One thing led to another. Some of it was good luck. Some of it was being in the right place at the right time, but also being one of the people who could actually do the work and knew what the job was and how to deliver. So that's how I got that.
I think for so many people working in the business, especially in the theater, all of the theater jobs, being in the union, even still today, is very important. Was it really gatekept back in the day, though? You hear horror stories about how hard it was back in the day to get into the unions because, you know, the more people in the union, the less work there was for everyone to go around. Did you, coming into New York, did you find it difficult to get accepted? Was it a closed club, or did you get, you know, did they kind of welcome you with open arms?
They did not welcome me with open arms.
I didn't think they would. No.
In all honesty, I took the union exam 3 years in a row. Wow. Before some friend spoke up for me and I was accepted. But it was not easy, and I was never welcomed, and I was never ever welcomed into the Broadway community for various reasons. I was on my own. And that's also part of the reason I turned to film, because none of that circle was working in film, and the people who were in film didn't give a shit about the other side of things.
Right.
So I was the new kid on the block in film and stayed there until I became, you know, eventually I was the old kid on the block.
Stephen, I have to tell you, I mean, we've been doing this podcast now with Beth for 5 years. This is our fifth season. We've been doing it since COVID year, since 2020. And I think your name has probably come up more than anyone else's over the years. So I know Beth already welcomed you, and it is an honor to have you here. But I have to say, as someone who has listened to Beth talk about you so glowingly for so long, it's a real honor and treat for us to have you, because I think where Beth is kind of flows through who you are. So, you know, as far as pulling back the curtain, I'm very excited to have you here just to understand Beth a little bit more.
Well, that's great. We should focus on the projects that we have done.
There are so many.
Oh, no, for sure. For sure. I want to stay in the past a little bit longer, though, because
okay.
I think because you and Beth have been in the industry for so long, and Beth often talks about the time before technology really took over, and I think you could probably speak to that, too. So to talk a bit about the quote-unquote good old days when drafting and drawing happened with a pencil, when you needed that skill, and how did you feel when the industry did move to computers and to drafting on computers and technology really seeped in? Did that dampen the business for you or change it dramatically for you?
I would not say it changed it dramatically, but it did change it. But certainly in the good old years, if we want to call them that, the 70s, the 80s, even the earliest part of the 90s, I would have a drafting room of three or four men, women, whoever, sitting at drafting tables and drawing with a pencil, one thing after another. All the work was created by hand. And I found that the people who had to then execute those drawings, the carpenter shop particularly, appreciated that. Those men had grown up with the pencil drawings. They were not computer literate themselves. So a pencil drawing of a set with all of its details worked out in all the different ways that you do in drafting was the language that we all spoke. When the computer came in, first of all, not all the art directors who did the drafting were familiar with it. So I would have an art department with perhaps one person on a computer and two people on a drafting table with pencils. Gradually that changed. And as it did, the carpenters were not happy with it because computer drafting was prone to errors. If you don't click the exact right thing and put the right number in, then the drawing is wrong.
Set decoration department wasn't happy with it because when the measurements were wrong for the carpenters, they built something that made it very hard for the set decorators. So that was also one issue. But truly, throughout Stephen's entire career, he could speak to anything and anyone on a movie, producer, director, writer, just by doing a pencil drawing right in front of them. And that is a form of communication that went away.
I also found it important, even on the last job that I did, which was the series Evil for Robert King and Michelle King. We did the first season of Evil. And even though I had two men on computers drafting, I still had one person who had been with me a number of years drafting with a pencil. Because certain sets that were repetitious, say, I always use the example, say a hospital. A hospital is a pretty boring thing to draw. It's rectangular, it's formulaic, one room after another, etc. That stuff was easy on computer. When you get to more complicated, and I'll say period houses or a Gothic church, it's very useful to have somebody skilled in pencil drawing who knows how to draft period details, moldings, fireplaces, cornices, that sort of thing, which you could somehow or another research and import to a computer, but just to have a draftsman who knows the vocabulary and is able to whip it out with a pencil is great.
It feels like a lost art. You know, there's so much stuff that you lose, just the shading and the detail. We see it in animation, right? I mean, they can do amazing things with computer graphic and animation, but there's something about hand-drawn cells that just looks better, yes, or richer, yes, or deeper.
Yes. Yes. You can compare early Disney, Cinderella, Bambi, anything with the latest output from Pixar or Disney, and it's flat and it doesn't have the touch of an artist to it.
Right. There's a life to the hand drawn that comes off of the cell.
Definitely.
All right. So now let's jump forward to the mid-2000s, because you and Beth have collaborated on many jobs and many jobs before you guys got together for The Good Wife. But it was The Good Wife that really brought both of you, I think, lots of attention. The production design, the set deck, they became so iconic. And I think you guys entered the conversation in a real way. There are articles after articles about that show referencing you guys.
Yes.
What was the recognition like as one whose career had always been behind the scenes? This is for both of you. I'd love to hear from Beth too. What was it like to all of a sudden now have people talking to you about what you've been doing at that point for years, but now you were kind of the star of the thing? Was that jarring for you? Was it something to adjust to?
It was certainly new. You know, suddenly I was doing a video for YouTube and Beth was all over the internet with pictures and weekly conversations with people who were watching it. We were being noticed in a very immediate way. You know, you do a movie and maybe it's a year before it comes out and they sort of maybe run a little feature in something, or maybe they don't, but it's not immediate. This was a dialogue that went on back and forth with the public all the time for years. It took a little while for it to get started, but once it started and she was on Instagram and so forth, and I was being interviewed and did video for YouTube. It may still be there. I don't know. It's so long ago. I doubt it. But
no,
that was all new.
There.
That yeah. was all new to us. I think we responded pretty well.
there was an accessibility factor where it sort of jived within the same time that people could find us sort of easily through the internet. And to start with, I think I've mentioned this before, the network was getting so many inquiries about Alicia's apartment that the mail we were getting was being checked for anthrax in those days.
That's
you know,
crazy.
It was sort of surprised, I think, certainly us, but it surprised the network and their publicity department at CBS for the show, you know, sort of made the whole thing accelerate by having me tweet during the episodes. And, you know, all of a sudden it was just really commonplace for someone to say, where did you get that lamp? Where did you get that rug? You know, and they were all kind of standard sources, but the way we put it together was very appealing to people and they had no hesitation in reaching out. I think that made it different. Like in years prior, you know, if someone wanted to know where something was from, it was a rare thing for them to find me.
Also, the show itself hit the zeitgeist and became a hit at a perfect moment. So the fact that The Good Wife and Juliana Margulies and the unusual quality of the writing of the show and the unusual quality of the cast made the show a hit. Therefore, we were in the conversation. There were long articles in the New Yorker magazine about our show and about our producers. There were features in the New York Times repeatedly about the producers and who was in the show and how their scripts were relating to what was going on in various law cases or in the politics and in the age of Trump and so forth. So there was a general conversation about The Good Wife going on in the press and in the world, so that the conversation about our work sort of naturally flowed into that because it was visible. It was part of the visible part of what people were seeing. And also the side of the costumes. There was a great deal of focus on the costume work to stylishly dress these people. Our show looked like nothing else on television. It had high style from beginning to end in every character, in every scene, in the writing, in the concept of it. It was unlike anything on television. That's why it became such a hit. It was prime TV. It was prime, what's now on streaming. It was prime TV before streaming took off. We started in 2009. In 2009, half the streaming channels out there, or most of them, didn't even exist. Right. Now they're all trying to do that. But we were the first show that, in fact, it kind of prompted CBS to start its streaming channel, because then The Good Wife was the first thing up on it.
Man, if you guys could only get residuals on being trendsetters, right? If you could only take a little piece of the action from every show that went to town on the style and aesthetic that you guys helped create.
Well, this was really
another character in the show.
We wouldn't be on here. We'd be retiring on the French Riviera or something. You know?
We would all be on a boat with a drink. Right? We would still be, but like microphones on a boat on a beach somewhere where it's warm. So
I'm committed to doing the podcast. Even when I make those residuals.
Did you guys know, though, when you were doing this? You both have so many credits that predate this show. I mean, Stephen, you have Wall Street and Arthur, two iconic New York movies that I think about all the time, both of them, especially Wall Street. Then it's The Good Wife, 20, 30 years in. You know, did you know?
There's a big difference between movies and television in terms of that, because movies come out and they get their notice and they run for a month or a year or whatever, and then they're over. Television goes on, and we've done so many shows, and I think Beth will pretty much agree with me. This is the first show in all the years of all the television I've done that ran even one full season. And I always say, when we start, if we're still working, because you generally start work in the summer, June, July, August, you start there, and then the first show airs in September. And I say, if we still have a job by Thanksgiving, then we're going to go.
He said that all the time, because I was the eternal optimist, always saying, oh, this one's going to make it for like five seasons. This is going to be a hit. And I can't tell you how many times he said, I told you, if we make it to Thanksgiving. And, you know, they would come right before Thanksgiving and say, we're not even finishing this season. The show's not getting picked up.
Because they have had enough ratings. If the show starts, generally television shows start right after Labor Day. So by mid-November, they've had, 8 weeks or so. They have a good sense of what the ratings are. And if the ratings are not where they want them, you're done. So Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving, don't come back, you know. Or we were picked up. We didn't know at the beginning of Good Wife, but we were picked up right around there, somewhere in November. And it just went on from there. However, even at the end of first season, you don't know if you're renewed for season two. But it didn't take long to get the season two renewal. It wasn't like a cliffhanger. There was so much invested in it and such a strong belief in the Kings and in Juliana Margulies that it was picked up and, you know, we went on forever and ever.
I think it was also that it was really seen for the first time. And remember, you know, when we were doing The Good Wife, it was 22 episodes a season.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like a streaming show of six episodes or eight episodes, but the show's Look was actually considered another character, and there was a lot of focus on how that character played into all of the episodes.
Well, you could really live with the character in a 22-episode season.
Right.
You can really play with it and do your own arc that's not in the script.
And,
you know?
And that drove the set design in that the sets had to be complicated enough, have enough depth to them, enough areas to shoot, enough rooms, as it were, to shoot, to maintain interest. It wasn't like a sitcom that has a living room and a kitchen. That's it, you know, and you shoot it in 28 minutes or 22 minutes. This was an hour show, which is in fact only 44 minutes or 45 minutes, whatever. But it had to be a complete world for Juliana and her family, her children, to live in, with every bathroom, every bedroom, every nook and cranny, the laundry, everything fully built out so that the stories could develop. You wouldn't see all of that every episode, but episode by episode, you would explore that world. And sometimes you, oh, look, we're in Juliana's bedroom. We haven't been there before. Or we're in one of the children's rooms that we only saw, maybe it was four episodes in before we used that bedroom, but it was a natural part of the life of that family to move from room to room to room. So it had to be complete. The same with the law office. It had lots of rooms, and it had an upstairs and a downstairs, and it had different entrances and specific areas for each character that all had to be developed and dressed and thought through for the uses of that character. And you didn't necessarily see it every week or every episode, but over the course of 22 episodes, you certainly explored the entire world that we could create.
I found this quote from Beth that I think so well dovetails with what you just said. And because it's from 2010, I feel like it's worth reading. It'll take a second.
Okay.
Because I think it's perfect for what you just said. Beth was giving an interview. You both were actually in this article. It was from Art Departmental. It was about the show. It was brand new. Beth said, as a set decorator, I think it's all about the details. Even though things like a collection of fortunes from fortune cookies placed in the bowl in the kitchen, which was my 8-year-old daughter's contribution, or bedside table junk in the bedroom, coins, a random earring, a chiropractor's business card. Most likely those things will never be seen on screen, but they give life to the sets, and I find them very necessary to complete the lived-in feeling.
Right.
This is the world you guys are creating. You are world-building in a way that I think viewers feel, even if they're not aware of it, right? You're making connections, right?
Well, you're doing it for the actors and for the general atmosphere of the set. And you create this world, and you also, it demands respect from the people who work on the set. You know, they have to treat it as though they're really in a person's house. And I'm a great believer in what Beth said there. I remember years ago on a movie I did, I had a different set decorator, but well, it was before Beth and I started working together.
Okay.
I mean,
it was before my time.
It was. But the point is, this person was kind of new at the business. And I explained to him what I expected. And I said, even the inside of a dresser drawer has to be thought through and dressed, because this character might open that drawer, or you might just open it, not necessarily in the scene, but just hanging around the set. And you want him to feel like, oh, he really does inhabit this space.
Right.
So always think of that dresser drawer story, because I fully believe in that.
We're writing the character's backstory.
Right. Flushing out the character fully.
What were some of the questions from Michelle and Robert King that when you were getting ready to do the show that played a part in the concept for the design you came up with for the show?
Well, I would say it was less questions than concepts that Robert had in his mind. First of all, they had done a pilot in Vancouver on location before they then were picked up and came to New York, and then we got hired. And there was a characteristic of this office that he quite liked, but he really wanted to expand on, and because it was a location, it wasn't really perfect. But his concept was that it was life in a fishbowl. that within both the apartment and in the law office, there was glass. There were no places you could hide. Mm. You were visible everywhere. So particularly the law office, we centered around a conference room entirely wrapped in glass walls and glass doors so that from every angle within that set, you could see out of an office with glass walls into the hallways and then into the conference room. Everybody had their eye on everybody else.
Which is a major feat in shooting because of all the glass.
Yeah, so it was very, very difficult for shooting. But at the same time, we did everything possible to make it work by having most of the glass swivel and pivot so that panes of glass, which were enormous, they were 3 foot by 7 foot high, they were on pivots. So you could angle them to kill the reflections and still have the sense of looking through a glass wall. So that facilitated the shooting as best we possibly could. But they were always fighting it and always trying to get reflection of a light or a reflection of a camera out of the glass so you're seeing through the glass clearly. But essentially, the concept really did work. We reworked it almost every year. We rebuilt that law office set. People would have a different office, or Robert would have a different concept of where this would go or that would go. And we created two totally different areas, the upstairs and the downstairs. And those got reworked time and again so that it gave it a fresh approach to the shooting and also showed the evolution of the firm as it changed management from one person to another, because all of that internal struggle within the law firm was a great part of the drama. Who was up, who was down, who got fired, who took over, who got their name on the door. So we would rebuild to reflect those things, while Giuliano's home never got rebuilt.
My favorite directive that spoke to me the most visually that was given was, law is a blood sport. And, you know, that was something that we also focused on.
Yes, that was kind of Robert's approach to the scripts and to the relationships. It was always a competition, a struggle within the world. And that was played out, in the colors we used, the very, very minimal use of red. But if there was red, it meant something. We generally did not use bright colors. Within the law firm, we didn't use bright colors, period, unless there was a real reason for that. Those colors would reflect a concept.
And we did go with the warm tones in the office and the cooler tones, certainly in her apartment and in the outside world.
So there's a stability in her home, though. So how did you contrast this office that was going to change, say, season over season or even over the course of a season versus the home, which maybe is going to be more stable, is not going to be revamped constantly? Do you have to take more time when you're setting that up? You're not going to change the colors, Beth, right? You're not going to change that eggplant dining room every week. People don't do that. They paint their room and then they generally leave it there. So is that like more forethought? Like, we have to get this right out of the gate to make sure it's setting the right tone?
We definitely felt we had to get it right out of the gate. One of the things about the very beginning was it was a digital shoot. None of us were really that familiar with digital shooting, with digital cameras and how they take color and light and what those colors and what that light looks like, how much light, so forth. So we did an awful lot of testing. I mean, large paint samples were made for both the law firm and the apartment. Wallpaper samples shown. Everything was tested and tested and tested until we arrived at things that would work digitally, because it's quite different from film. It's one of the reasons we stayed away from certain things. There's no yellow. For instance, yellow was problematic digitally because it bleeds. It doesn't keep a hard edge. Reds flare. The least little square of red jumps off the screen. So those were all controlling factors.
But don't you think those factors pushed us I mean, we were like a little crazy with the eggplant dining room and the choices that we made. It was fun because we sort of pushed the envelope a little.
Well, we wanted it to be stylish for her. You know, the concept was she had moved from Chicago suburbs, from Highland Park, and bought an apartment in a good area of downtown Chicago. And she had it done. You know, she didn't go to the store and buy paint and do it herself. Somebody professionally put that place together.
Yeah, that was our backstory. She had a good decorator.
Yeah, that responded with contemporary ideas and contemporary furniture, but, you know, with the appropriate antiques mixed in. But it was not a modern high rise. This was a classic old apartment, probably built in the 20s or 30s, with moldings and lots of rooms and interesting layout. It wasn't a box in the sky with glass walls. That's what we had with the law firm. So this was her nest, her comfort place, that was the colors that were comforting, the size of things, the velvet on the sofa. All of those things brought comfort to her. She's in the process of a divorce from this renegade husband who's actually, when the series starts, he's on his way to jail. So we had a lot of him in jail, contrasting gray, cold jail with her house.
We even had a lot of conversation about a queen-size bed versus a king-size bed. You know, the king-size bed would have symbolized both of their lives together there as a couple. Right. And at first we were going to go with a queen size bed. The rationale was, you know, it's her apartment, she's there without him. And then we ended up changing that concept and we went with a queen size bed. And in one of the earlier episodes, you know, we see her in bed feeling the weight of the world, and she looks really small in the king size bed by herself.
The producers were very insistent that it had to be a big bed, even though we had designed the room for a normal queen-size bed. So it kind of was oversized in the room, but it made sense in terms of emotionally and visually where she was.
But people also do that, though, right? I mean, people have they get into an apartment, they have a certain size room, they still go get a bed that maybe doesn't actually fit that room, and they make it work. I mean, that is real slice of life stuff that reflects how a lot of people go about their business and can't let go of that big bed, even if they do look tiny in it.
And eventually, in the course of the story, we do find another person in that bed with her. Yeah. It took years, but season three also, or four or something. But
we also developed her side of the bed. You know, right. A lot of stuff happened in that nightstand and those lamps, bizarrely enough, which I don't know, those ended up being her lamps because they were a really good height. They were really tall. And there were, you know, during this whole flood of conversations about the look of the show, there was actually an entire Twitter chat that took place among fans in Europe about those lamps, you know, Alicia's bedside lamps. I mean, it was really amazing. That transcript exists somewhere.
Beth, I wanted to actually talk to you about the beach glass. We have talked about this. It was a big reveal a couple of years ago when you announced the color. But we never really talked about how you settled on it. Now, we've talked a little bit how the approach was to Alicia's home. But because it became so popular, iconic.
Well, Stephen and I tested a lot of colors. And
Lightning, though? Was it a lightning bolt when that one?
No, it was not a lightning bolt. It was a considered decision that was the result of extensive testing. I had an entire wall in my office of wallpaper samples, paint samples, entire ranges of colors to finally get the correct choice and then get the samples and have them tested by the camera. There's nothing.
It wasn't
lightning
random.
Bolts are good for the middle of the night ideas, but they are not how you professionally do a set.
But I was especially loving that color because I used it. I had used it in my house at that point. So I was advocating for beach glass.
We were really fortunate in finding a wallpaper for that living room that exactly matched all the needs we had. It had that soft green tone in it, but it also had a gold filigree overprinted and some other little texture to it. So it wasn't flat like paint would be. It had some depth and subtlety to it. And that became incredibly popular. People wanted that wallpaper.
Yes, one of the most common things I got asked for, and unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore.
So we actually had to move the set three times. We were on one stage at the studios, and for various production reasons, another stage became available that was larger for us. So the entire set was dismantled and moved several blocks away to a new setting, at which point we had to re-wallpaper because the wallpaper got damaged in that. It then had another disaster happen where we had a flood because bad rains and things got flooded. The floors got flooded. Everything had to be taken out. The floors had to be rebuilt. The wallpaper had to be redone. And eventually, somehow or another, we found a supply of this wallpaper somewhere. Maybe it was Florida, yeah. Maybe somewhere else. I'm not sure. But that was kind of the end of it. There was no more of that particular wallpaper.
Memo to CBS, please stop moving our set. We can't re-wallpaper anymore. Right.
And if you bring back the good wife, she's going to be in a different apartment. Because
Let's talk about setting location, because you guys shot in New York. People may not realize that. You shot in Brooklyn, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, but that's where the stages were. Yes,
right. But it is a show that takes place in Chicago, as did The Good Fight later on. Yeah. What did you have to consider in selecting locations to represent the Windy City? How do you make New York look like Chicago?
The number one thing is we avoided the Empire State Building. It was always a consideration. And even though we shot a lot out on the streets, we chose generic backgrounds that could be another large city. It was never specifically Chicago we were trying to duplicate. We didn't change street signs from Fifth Avenue to Michigan Avenue. We just avoided the issue pretty much and stayed away from recognizable landmarks.
Also, when we first started, it was a really insular show. You know, we had maybe 2 days out an episode. We were mostly courtroom, office, home. So we were mostly on the sets. It was in the later years that we did more exterior location work.
Yeah, but always that location work had an eye towards things we would avoid and things that were acceptable to shoot. And, you know, we shot a great deal on the streets, but we stayed away from what would be recognizable as Midtown Manhattan. First of all, there are a lot of restrictions of where you can comfortably shoot in New York. So staying away from Midtown Manhattan is not that difficult. You just shoot on the fringes, and not much of what we were doing ever required that sort of thing. But for instance, we shot a lot around new skyscrapers that are in Long Island City. That's sure. Was right adjacent to our stages in Brooklyn. And that would be the outside of a glassy skyscraper, you know, with a beautiful lobby and glass doors and all of that. But we were in Long Island City and it was generic. You know, there was nothing about it. And you could look up and down the street and across the street. And it was still generic. You never saw a New York taxi cab. And you could look all the way down the block and see an elevated train. And Chicago has elevated trains. So the fact that we had a New York subway 4 or 5 blocks down away from us was perfectly acceptable.
15 years earlier, Long Island, you know, city would have been a different area of Chicago.
Yeah.
So you guys were there at the right time. I guess you can't make the Empire State Building look like the Sears Tower. I don't know what angle that would be at to do that. Beth, when you're doing the set deck pieces, what were you thinking to make you think this is Chicago? You are a New York girl, born and bred.
Yeah.
How are you selling us on Chicago in your top layer of life?
Definitely in the top layer of life. You know, if anyone focuses, and I've had questions because I know they do focus on things like the bulletin board in the kitchen, has Chicago menus, pizza, deep dish pizza from Chicago.
Yeah.
We got some product placement. You know, we started with that whole layer. You know,
I think we got something from the Art Institute of Chicago.
Yes, we did. We got clearance from the Art Institute. We had, a random tote bag and sort of wherever we could not, we could do it legally and wherever it would read. There are plenty of Ode to Chicago things, even in the office. We did maybe a iconic Chicago place on a mug that sat on someone's desk. But we had in the shop, actually at the end of one whole aisle, we had our Ode to Chicago, Chicago snow globes and all the things like that. And it does, you know, make a difference.
I'm going to ask this one for both of you, just because this is the kind of behind the scenes people love to hear about. What's a favorite set from either The Good Wife or The Good Fight? And we're staying with these shows because they were so popular. They remain so popular. I just talked to someone last week who's just started streaming them on Paramount Plus. Steven, do you have a favorite set from your time working on The Good Wife or The Good Fight?
Well, I'm thinking about it, but I have to say, within the Alicia apartment, I think the living room is just the most divine room. I just love that room. I love her sitting on that couch and you look past her and you can see the foyer or you can see the dining room or you see the fireplace with the beautiful painting we had done over it. There's just something absolutely iconic about that room and that show. So I would say that's my favorite set from there.
How about you, Beth? What, when you think back on that time?
Definitely. I remember when the show was over, we were having a sale of the set decoration, and I was sitting in the set mourning it. And really, I think having moved that set completely all those times and now packing it up forever, I think I agree with Steve in the living room, but there was something really great, I think, because I coveted it the most. Alicia's bathroom, which we didn't see often, but it was so grand in size. But there were touches in Alicia's bathroom that really meant a lot to me. And the kitchen was probably, I was the most asked about the kitchen and living room. You know, I think Stephen's idea of those bookcases that define the living room, you know, on both ends, it was just a place that everyone could sort of, it was really attainable, but everyone thought it was aspirational. And, you know, that's what came out so much in the articles and in my blog and conversations with people. You know, it was pretty much done because of the timing and what we got out of it. It had to be done quickly, and it was all sort of really attainable sources. And then, of course, the furnishings and the Good Wife collection and Good Fight collection with Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams made some of those pieces iconic.
It's amazing. I mean, it definitely had a lasting effect that, I mean, people still have probably in their homes today. Let's talk a little bit about how the sausage get made. I know you guys are being very gracious with all your time here, but I don't know when we'll have you back, Stephen. So I want to make sure we get everything out now.
Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm happy to stay.
You guys are always working on two episodes simultaneously, right? You're prepping one, you're shooting the other. How do you find the time to quote unquote like serve all of the masters and devote split your focus? Beth, I'm going to ask you the same thing after this too.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I have a staff. There's an art director, and then there are other art directors under him. And there is all the staff that Beth has. So, you know, there are people doing things for you all the time. So you go out, get in the van and go find the next thing and come back with that information and throw all that at them. So first of all, you don't spend all the time away from the, you spend maybe half the day or three quarters of the day looking for the new stuff, and then you come back to the studio and you execute on what you have to do right away. It's a division of your time, and you just manage it. That's the way it's built, and everybody knows that that's the way it's built. You have a new script. You're going to all sit down, break it all down, have a production meeting, know what the job is. At the same time, you've already prepped all the stuff that they're needing for the current episode, and it's underway, and the staff is doing it. It's the way the job works, and the whole place works on that system, that everybody is both prepping and shooting all at once. So you just do it.
I mean, the interesting part of it is that the production designer and the art department and the set decoration department is, you know, one of the only departments that is doing every episode. You have a different director. You have, for each episode, you have different assistant directing teams. You know, so we're always prepping and shooting at the same time, whereas you have a different DP, director of photography.
Yeah.
So they're focusing, you know, their focus is single focused on one episode. But, you know, Stephen and I and our collaboration and mind meld that we have had through the years, I think, you know, it gives us a unspoken way of communicating that, you know, I know what he expects and what he wants, and we knew the level of the show. And there were many times that he laughed, I didn't laugh, when I would call him and say, this set is not fitting my furniture, and I'm not gonna be able to do this. And he would say, yes, you are. Try it again.
I'll come in and move the couch to the other side, and it'll be
exactly
fine.
So, you know, but we did have a system, and that's what it takes. You know, he goes with the prepping director, and I stay home with the shooting director.
Yeah.
And it really is a mindset that you have to get your head wrapped around, but it works.
I would go out with the scout, and we'd, you know, maybe pick a location, like, we're going to shoot in this house. And I would take some pictures, make a rough sketch of what the plan would be, where the furniture is, what the script and the director have asked for, and come back to the office and download it immediately. I don't mean into a computer. I mean with my heads of departments, and tell them, we're going to have to paint this room, and you're going to have to bring in six chairs to go in front of whatever. So that already they know before we even go on the tech scout, which won't be for a few more days, and right before the shoot, they already know we're going to have these things. So it's a building up of the information process that keep everybody informed, so there aren't last minute surprises, and so that you can execute on a very short time frame.
I was looking over your IMDb and your credits, Stephen, and I came upon Muppets Take Manhattan. And I'd love to take a left turn down there, because Caroline, who's our normal co-host, her family are tremendous fans of Jim Henson and his work. They know several of the puppeteers. Like, they're very, they love the work. So I felt like I needed to ask you about your work on that and the movie. And how does designing that kind of production differ from, say, a non-Muppet cast? I imagine there's a lot of different consideration that you have to go into when you're designing for Kermit and his friends.
Well, the Muppet world is a totally stylized world. They're not real. And even though in Muppets Take Manhattan, it actually was something of a breakthrough in the way they conceived showing the Muppets, in that they are out in the real world. We see them on the streets of New York, which is somewhat new for this was, I think, only the second Muppet movie. Maybe it was the third. I'm not sure. But
I think it was the third.
They had never shot in New York, so you had never placed the Muppets in a real environment the way they were placed in Muppets Take Manhattan. So that was new. And how do you manage that? And how do you actually shoot them? Because the Muppets have to have beneath what you see the entire structure of the puppeteers and the equipment they need and the dollies they're on and their monitors and so forth. So it's a complicated thing to get them outdoors. and have them be in a physical relationship to perspective and sidewalk and horizon line and so forth. So there was all that to deal with. But then in the world that is not outside, that's in the sets, it's a very stylized world. It's a heightened reality and a simplified reality. Things are a little sillier and a little more colorful and a little bolder than they would be for a set that was with human actors only. Contrasting, say, the agent's office with the offices that you later see in my work from all the office movies, Wall Street and right. all the way down to The Good Wife. So there's that difference. There also was the fact that Muppets Take Manhattan was the first movie directed by Frank Oz. Jim Henson was in the movie and participated, but he was not the director. So my relationship was with Frank as a director. So that was new for all of them, you know, to not have Jim in the driver's seat.
Did you feel that in the set? Was that an adjustment that you were feeling coming through the production?
I don't know. I had never worked with Jim as a director, so I really can't say that there was a difference from that point of view.
Right.
I did find that Frank seemed to be very knowledgeable about what he needed and what he wanted, and I think we delivered 100% to fill those ideas and to my own concepts of how they should be presented. I think we also established early on a palette that we thought we would carry through the whole movie, and we pretty successfully did that also. The pink and the blue palette kind of gave a childlike atmosphere to the whole world that the Muppets were in.
It's one of those transitional Muppet movies, right? Because they were out in the world. And I feel like it was one of those yes. times for kids who had grown up and then they had seen the original movie, had watched them on Sesame Street, had watched the yeah. Muppets primetime yeah. variety show. It yeah. was, it was like, wow, this is them in a new way. So I think it probably doesn't strike you, but as someone who consumed it and was really affected by it at a very young age, I'm 6 when it comes out, but watching it with my parents, and it made a lasting impact on me. Yeah. So, you know, I want to thank you. And I know on behalf of Caroline and her family, I want to thank you for them, too. So it's just an iconic piece of work that really seamlessly brought them to life in a way even more so than they had ever been before.
Well, so. What was different and what Frank wanted to emphasize, what was different as occasionally in Sesame Street, but really in the first two movies, is that Frank wanted to really develop it as the characters real relationships with each other and bring that out, which builds all the way through the movie to the wedding, you know, which is the ultimate in a relationship building, while downplaying what had been emphasized in the first two movies, which was really slapstick, knockabout, knockdown craziness that they would do with each other. This movie played that down considerably and more built up the relationships with each other, the problems Kermit gets into when he loses his memory, and then you go off into the world where he's with the advertising agency and so forth, and abandons the showbiz part, and they knock that out of him when they discover him in the diner with the advertising people, and we get back to the basic thing that is the through line of all those things, is let's put on a show. The first movie is they go to Hollywood. This one, you know, they go to Broadway. And that's right. the through line to the from college to New York to Broadway.
It was your story.
It's my story, yes. That's why I identified with it so much.
I love that so much. We have one final question here before we let you go. Thinking back, you had a very long career. You did some amazing things, but I have to imagine there was some challenge that you faced that stands out to you, or taking it a positive spin on it, something that you look back on and you remain particularly fond of. What is that project for you that you think about when you look back?
You better say one that I worked on with you.
Well, I can say one that we did together, I think we can both say was probably the nadir of our movie making careers, the Amish in the countryside.
For richer or for poorer.
We'll leave that one unmentioned.
Yeah.
But among my favorites, clearly, are the two that people recognize me for, and that's Wall Street and Arthur. I have particular fondness for Arthur, and I realize, you know, Liza and I are the only two people still alive from that project.
Wow.
This is true. I hate to say, almost every director I've worked for, except for Frank and Oliver, has died, and quite a while ago, in fact. You wonder why I never have any second features with some of these people. It's because they all died. The director of Arthur died within 6 months or so of an opening.
Amazing.
Steve Gordon, John Schlesinger, of course, died. Michael Ritchie died. Bruce Paltrow died. So
okay, let's...
Yeah. I've survived everybody.
Yes, you have, and continue to. Thank you so much for joining us today, Stephen. This has just been incredible.
Yeah, you were a treasure. Thank you so much for bringing your career and yours and Beth's collaboration kind of to life for us today. It's been a treat.
It's been an honor to be invited, and I'm eager to hear when it's put together. So we'll talk then.
Sounds good. Thanks so much. And listeners, thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you for next week. Take care.
I want to send Stephen the sincerest thank you for not only making time to speak with us, but for his years of friendship and mentorship. I hope our listeners enjoyed that conversation. His insights are behind-the-scenes gold from an industry legend. It's a podcast that I think people will listen to over and over again.
Okay, guys, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. A special thank you to Stephen Hendrickson for coming on today. We were so lucky to have you. Listeners, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home at Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please leave a 5-star review. It helps a lot in promotion of the show. 5 stars, people. Thanks so much for listening.
Decorating the Set from Hollywood to Your Home is an original Pod Clubhouse production, recorded, edited, and produced at Pod Clubhouse Studios. For more information, please visit us online at podclubhouse.com. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Decorating the Set at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.